Today's program has been brought to you by GreatBrewers.com, a social media marketing platform dedicated to promoting the world's great brewers and the beers they create. For more information, visit GreatBrewers.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Jimmy's number 43 with some very exciting guests who are just passing through New York. Since we could not let them leave town without joining us on Beer Sessions Radio, we asked them to join us at Jimmy's number 43 for a pre-recorded session. I'm feeling very proud to be sitting with Luke Bobo van Mechelen and Tim Webb and Steve Beaumont. So let's go first to Tim and Steve. Tim and Steve, the authors of the new World Atlas of Beer. Appreciate that you guys are here. So you're kicking off your tour of your book, right?
Yeah, this is the first stop. This is ground zero for the tour of the World Atlas. We're pretty excited about the book. It's out in now, I think, 11 countries in 6 or 7 different languages. So it's a pretty exciting endeavor.
And Steve, we know your work from Ale Street News, which I've read, but I know you write for quite a few publications. And Tim, I was looking at your site today. You've written so many great books, Good Beer Guide to Belgium. How did you guys start working together?
Well, we kind of met about 15 years ago in a bar in Toronto called Smokeless Joe's by accident, because I was there and I was looking for beer. And I was in conversation with a guy who owned it, and I said, I write the Good Beer Guide to Belgium. And he said, there's someone you must meet who writes the Good Beer Guide to Canada. And that's actually how it began. And then we met each other occasionally over about 15 years. We got on quite well. And then out of the blue, I get this phone call which says, would you like to write a world atlas of beer? And I thought, no, because I can't do the U.S. I can't do most of the American part of the world. And so I initially turned it down. Then the next morning I woke up and I said, I know how I can do this. I can do this with Steve. And so then we spent 18 months working together doing this book.
Well, that's great. And also, Bobo from Chimay, he's the brand ambassador in the United States for Chimay. He's here at the table with us with his New York rep, Red, from Union Beer. Bobo, welcome to the table.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, and I'm very glad to see. I never met Tim before, but know of him, and then of course my friend, my Canadian friend here. It's been a long time since we have seen each other. So,
well, you're a legend, and I'm happy to meet you. You look like your name sounds. You're rugged.
Yeah.
I'm sure you drink a lot of beers, and we've got Chimay Red in front of us. And why don't you tell us a little bit about that beer? And
well, Everybody sitting around the table knows about beer. This is one of the... there's actually 8 Trappist monasteries now. There's just a new one that came on board in Austria. I don't even know the name, to be honest with you. Any of you guys know?
Well, if you want to get technical here, they're not yet a Trappist brewery.
Oh, they're not? Okay.
No, they have to be approved by the Vatican Council or something, okay. And the Trappists have to put them forward, but... that's just trying to get out the idea that I can't remember their name either.
They are actually brewing there, though. I know this for a fact. Konrad Seidel, who's Austrian, the beer papst or beer pope, I was in conversation with him just a couple of weeks ago, and he said that absolutely they are brewing there. They are producing beers. To his view, they're beers that need some age on them. Mm-hmm. And I'll... Of course, all of this is to get out of me forgetting what the name of the place is as well.
I'm sure we can Google it, but I already understand that Be United is going to be the importer for the United States for the beers, probably limited quantities.
Oh, I've actually been there. A couple of months ago, I cycled across Europe. One of the things, if you're a beer rider, you've got to do something to keep your weight down and stay fit.
Yeah, I got so a problem with that.
But I cycle, and I actually cycled down the Danube, and this mm-hmm. this place that is called something Cell, I'll get there eventually. It's a nice little monastery. It's directly by the Danube, Oh my God, I'm not going to get there. But yeah, I've actually been to the front door, but they didn't have any beer on sale. They said we're going to be brewing again in August. So
let's go back to. I want to just get us going. Let's talk about Chimay.
More about Chimay,
because you're like the flagship. Everybody knows Chimay. It brings people to beer. Lets them learn about Belgian beers.
I think one of the reasons that Chimay is very well known in the United States is that we've been here since 1983. So next year that will be 30 years. I ended up in the United States in 1979 because friends of mine, Americans that studied international law in Brussels, my hometown is Leuven, where Stella Artois is brewed, great university town, great party town. So these guys used to come and party in Leuven, and they fell in love with Duvel and Chimay and a bunch of other Belgian beers. And that's where they decided to start an import company that's called Manneken Brussels Import. And I came to visit them in 1979, and they talked me to open up the first Belgian bar and restaurant in Austin, Texas. And I did that for about 10 years, and then I started working for Pierre Selles, the father of Hoegaarden, that built the brewery in Austin as a brand manager. And that's pretty much how I got in the beer business. My friends at MBI 14 years ago, he said, I think we got enough money, we can afford you now, so why don't you come and work for us? And then in 2005, basically, Chimay wanted one importer in the whole United States. They used to be Manneken Brussels, Paterno, and Bellicus, and Chimay asked me to stay on board, and that's why mostly what I do with my time is representing Chimay.
What are some upcoming events that you'll be participating in?
Well, Red Deer is going to get they brewed a beer, the 150th anniversary beer, because this year Chimay is 150 years old, the brewery is. And so I will be doing events in different bars around the country that will get the 150th. Unfortunately, very limited quantity. They only shipped us 2,500 cases, so there's a lot of unhappy people out there.
Well, it's great to have, you know, you seem like an authentic beer guy.
Well, it's my hometown, Leuven, is an old Catholic university, and in the old days was the only brewing school in Belgium. Now, of course, you can go to Antwerp, Ghent, there's different brewing schools, so my family is having a pub on the main square in Leuven. It's called Gambrinus. It's been there for four generations, goes back to the 1800s. So most of the brewers in Belgium that went to college in Leuven used to come to my grandfather. So when I was touring with my friends, some of the breweries, and they said, "And who are you?" And I said, "Well, my name is Bobo van Mechelen. I'm the grandson of Cambrinus." And then they, "Oh, well, we used to know your grandfather." So I kind of fell a little bit into the beer world.
I have a question for Bobo, because I've always wanted to know this. Why Bobo?
Oh, it's the nickname. It's the nickname. It's a good story. It's a nickname that I received when I was about 16 years old. We were on vacation on the coast, and I happened to be dancing with the bar owner's wife on top of the bar. And
as you do,
pretty well. And they decided to give me a nickname, who was a little bit of a cartoon character in Belgium, Bobo. And for some reason, it stuck with me. Now, when I came to Austin, Texas in 79, Luc van Mechelen is a little bit long for the Texans. And so I said, "But I have a nickname, Bobo." And they said, "Ah, you're a Bubba." I said, no, it's Bobo, not Bubba. And it seems to work pretty well. If you say Luc van Mechelen from Chimay, nobody knows who I am. But you say Bobo from Chimay, they usually, "Oh, yeah, I met that guy somewhere." So it seems to work. You know, it's a name that easy to
it's
remember.
It's like you're a superhero. Kind of.
Yeah.
We've got some superheroes here. I mean, Tim and Steve, you guys really have... This book is pretty awesome. So it's like the next generation, or the somehow related to Michael Jackson's books, right?
Well, I mean, the publishers... It's originally UK published, which means it's the UK publishers kind of organize the thing. They are the same people who produced Michael's original book. Now... Beer has moved on so far since Michael wrote the first edition of his World Guide in 1977. I mean, the beer scene is unrecognizable compared to then. Because the problems he had when he was writing his book was just to get the information, because beer was down to being, if you like, vibrant in about four different countries only, anywhere in the world. There was a good beer scene in Czechoslovakia. There was a good beer scene in the western part of Germany. The beer scene in the UK and Belgium was just on the edge. It was looking as if it might survive, but that was about it. The rest of the world, there was virtually nothing. Now, we come along 40 years later, and we're trying to look at the same subject, and actually, it's the world is incomparable, because we started off, when we began the book, we knew there was beer in a lot of countries. By the time we finished, we are saying there's about 45 countries in the world where there is an active major craft brewing scene, and there's about another 30 where it looks as if it's coming along. That's such a different world.
And even in the time since we finished the manuscript for the book, because of course there's a lag time between the manuscript and the actual publication of the book, things have happened. Like Poland, in 12 months, Poland has become a vibrant brewing scene, which just blows my mind that in as little as a year they've managed to do that. Spain is up and coming. Spain is really looking exciting now. Tim just went to Romania and he saw some rumblings happening down there. So there's a lot going on, and frankly, it was a daunting task to start with. Tim and I spent, I think, about an hour and a half or 2 hours on the phone dividing up the world, saying, you know, very Napoleonic, very saying, you know, okay, you take this, I'll take that, et cetera, et cetera. During which I uttered the three most regretted words of my life, which was, I'll take Germany. but it really was daunting to go into it, even thinking that you had some idea of what was going on around the world. By the time we came out of it a year later, I think both of us were reeling that we really hadn't had an idea of exactly how big the beer thing was globally. And it's only getting bigger now. It really is phenomenal to watch.
I'm just so psyched to have you guys here. Tell me more about Michael Jackson's book. I mean, when I first started in the beer business, that was the book I had for reference. And I know for the United States, it was pretty much Anchor Steam and a few other closed beer breweries that are no longer around. Trace your connection to Michael Jackson.
Michael was certainly a mentor for me. More a contemporary for Tim, because they're sorry, Tim, closer to the same age.
But no, relatively true, yeah.
But Michael was really a guiding light for me in terms of when I started writing about beer 22 years ago, and to go into this book and have it like full of Michael's legacy, because essentially we're trying to update what Michael did back in 77 and again in, I forget when the New World Guide came out, somewhere in the early 80s, to try to take that mantle and do it. I think it was eased certainly by the fact that both of us were friends of Michael and both of us felt that burden of kind of trying to do a good job in his memory. Also appeased a bit by the fact that we were using the same publishers, as they knew what we were doing and they knew what had come in the past. And I hope that we've done his legacy proud. I really do.
Well, it's a really good looking book. I mean, it's beautiful. There's photos. It does have the same feel as one of Michael Jackson's books. Mm-hmm. So, Tim, you're both going on tour for the next couple of weeks. Is that what's happening?
Well, what I'm hoping is I'm going to get about 2.5 weeks of North American tourism, and that Steve is going to be taking the brunt of all the difficult bits, like having to do the beer dinners, having to do the stand-up and talk stuff. He's doing all the TV stuff. That's fine by me. I'm just going to travel around the U.S. and Canada and enjoy the place, really, because there's a lot of you do have a remarkable number of breweries in this country, I'm just going to enjoy drinking the beer, really.
Are there any cities and or special establishments you're looking forward to visiting on your tour?
Well, we'll be down in Philadelphia, actually, tonight. We have events at Monk's and the Belgian Cafe tomorrow in Philly. And then on Friday, we're at the Durham Beer Festival, the World Beer Festival that's done by All About Beer magazine. And then after that, we're down in Texas doing events at the Flying Saucers. And then coming back up, we're doing 3 days of signings at the Great American Beer Festival.
It's a good time to be in America, right? I mean, we know all about Beer Fest. We know Wynn Bassett pretty well. And he's a guy in North Carolina. Do you know him,
Wynn? I know Wynn because I've been on the Beer Talk panel for All About Beer magazine for several years. And Wynn has taken that over, I think, about maybe 6 or 7 months ago. So he and I have talked about, you know, he's picking us up at the airport and we're going to hang out a bit together. The Friday night before the World Beer Festival, they've got a brewer's reception thing, and we're going to be there hanging out, and then doing a seminar at the Beer Fest where we talk about exactly how we managed to put this book together implausibly.
So, Tim, we're going to take a short break now. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio, talking more with the authors of The World Atlas of Beer and Bobo from Chimay.
So was I when I fell for you. You lit me up with all those fancy words just like a fuse. Filled my head with love and lies a memory can't erase. No longer.
You're listening to Goodbye by Cherry Holmes on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Jimmy's number 43 today, recording a special show with the authors of The World Atlas of Beer and Bobo from Chimay. So right now we're drinking an Italian lambic, Duccia Sec. What was your question, Bobo?
Yeah, I had a question for Tim, since Tim has written a book on Belgian beers, and I was under the impression, and that's why I'm asking a question to Tim, is lambic, is it protected? Like, you know, the Trappist name is protected by... you know, by the association of the monks, so nobody else can use the name Trappist. I was under the impression that lambic was that particular region just outside of Brussels where the Zenne Valley is, and that nobody else could use the name lambic, but I don't know.
Okay, now any listeners who are not really dedicated beer geeks had better switch off at this point, because this is just a little bit technical. The thing with the Trappist name is that the Trappist order... with backing from the Vatican, basically licensed the use of the term Trappist for a beer. So it's if you like almost a commercial licensing agreement, but from a religious order. Now with lambic, it is different. It's to do with the European Union, and the European Union has got 3 levels of acknowledgement that a particular product is of a local region or made in a particular way. Now, what the lambic brewers would like to do is get a proper appellation contrôlée, which is what applies to a lot of the wines and various other food and drink products around the EU. They have not achieved that. What they have achieved is a level whereby lambic is seen as as an official local product. Now, even then, it gets interesting, because you've got your dozen or so lambic makers or lambic blenders in the Peotenland and Brussels region in Belgium. There's one guy just set up literally a couple of hundred meters. Do you have yards or meters in the US? But it's whatever it is. Yeah, yards will do. They're roughly the same. South of the boundary for Peotenland, actually in the French-speaking part of Belgium. And he's set up making what are clearly and obviously very good Geuze's traditional style. I happen to know that coming over the horizon, there's going to be a couple of people who are using, who are blending Pyottenland Lambics, but in another part of Belgium. So will they be given the same sort of, it's not technically an appellation. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're not asleep at this point, then congratulations. But I think the problem really is nothing to do with this. The problem is that Lambic is a way of making beer that is different from ale. It's different from lager. It is a fundamental sub-style of beer. And what's going to be a challenge, I think, in the future is that as there are brewers all around the world who are starting to try to make spontaneously fermented wild yeast beers, should Lambic become a genuine appellation contrôlée for Belgium, and then the other revitalized types of beer around the world that are brewing with wild yeast, they should just be called something else. Mm-hmm.
Who decides the appellation? Would that be the Belgian Brewers Association, or
no?
That would be a worldwide association, or
As I understand it, it's a European Union.
Oh, it's European.
Yeah, it's a, I think it's a European Union given qualification. Okay. And
do any beers have an appellation? Because I know that there's a lot of discussion about whether Kolsch in Köln or Cologne has an appellation or not, and same with alt beer.
Well, my understanding is that there are essentially two levels of appellation. Then there is the third level that the Lambics have. It doesn't make much sense to me because the Kölsch has, I think, the lower of the two levels of appellation, but then so do certain other types of beer. And there's one that is really close to my heart, which is that there's a type of beer in Britain that is supposed to be found only in the Rutland area and is basically Ruddles County from about 30 years ago. And somehow, historically, this has managed to get some sort of appellation. Now, this makes no sense whatsoever. So I think the European Union has to get its act sorted out about what it's saying about beer. And this is quite important for the future because European beers come from a lot of different heritages. They've got a great future in the new world of craft beer around the world, and if the EU could help them to get their to become stylized in an historical way, in the same way that the American Home Brewers Association gets modern American beers stylized in a modern way, that could be really useful.
Great. One reason we asked that question is that we're drinking the Deutsche Sek, which is imported by Bee United, and I don't know who makes it. But we're enjoying it. And Tim, you're a Belgian expert. Steve, tell us about your other question. We're recording in the afternoon. We usually do this at 5 o'clock and on. Right now it's early for me. I think it's about 2 o'clock, but it's a big difference. And Steve, what was your question? You said that you wonder where Italians get their lambics. Is that it? Or do they not make lambics?
Bobo was asking during the break where the Italian brewers got their lambics, and the Italian brewers that I know who have blended beers in and Revelation Cat, the Italian brewer, they have definitely forged a good relationship with Cantillon. And it all comes down to one man, a guy named Lorenzo de Bove, who's known as Kowalska. And Lorenzo has been leading Italian beer delegations to Belgium for many years, and he's a good friend of the Cantillon Brewery. So a lot of these Italian brewers have forged relationships with Cantillon. So I would not be surprised if the Lambic from any Italian beer that was blended in might be Cantillon.
Well, my brain's on right now. This Deutsche Sek is from Del Borgo, and we know the brewer. So, yes. But check it out. I mean, Del Borgo is doing some great stuff. I mean, you get to travel a lot in the States. You guys are traveling in Europe. What do you think about Italian beers?
Who
got the Italian beers? That's what I want to know for the world out.
I got the Italian section. And you'll read in the book when you go out and buy it that I think that the Italians at the time that I wrote that, the Italians had made more progress in 5 years in terms of the quality of their beer than any other country I've ever experienced in 22 plus years of writing about beer. I was over in Milan judging beers, and it was two out of every three were kind of like, you know, this is not great. And the third was, this is okay. This is good. There were a lot of flawed beers. There was a lot of problems. And then 5 years later, just going through the whole Italian beer scene all over again, I was astounded at the leaps forward they had made. They really had improved tremendously.
Yeah, I mean, I'd go with that. I mean, I was very pleased that Steve agreed to do the Italian section of the book, because it was just so complicated, it was just going to beat me. But what I would say overall was that Italy has been the first country in Europe to go out and do its own thing in beer. It hasn't just imitated what everybody else is doing. It's started to develop its own style. And I see that coming on with two other countries at the moment. France, which is not seen generally as a beer country, there are currently 400 breweries in France. This is extraordinary. It's five times as many as there were 10 years ago. And okay, half of these are going to go bust in the next couple of years. But of the rest, there's going to be some that are going to be world-class brewers within 10 years. And another country coming over the horizon, similar to Italy and France, and it's a wine country, is Spain, where Spain doesn't even have a tradition of being a beer brewing country. Spain has decided, I think because of restaurants like El Bulli that have just pushed the boundary on food, it's going to push the boundary on beer. And there's some beers already coming out of Spain that are just astonishingly different. And this is really exciting times. It's like Europe is imitating what the U.S. has done in the last couple of years, or in the last decade or two, but it's doing it European style, in that it's doing something in a kind of automatically old-fashioned way, and in a funny sort of way, awkward way, rather than the more orderly and businesslike style.
And let's not
US.
Forget Poland, who are now rediscovering what. I know, rightly or wrongly, I'm not entirely sure because the jury is still out, but are allegedly historic Polish beer styles, and they're recreating them, and Poland's now becoming a major force.
Yeah, Poland is definitely one to watch. Steve and I are both feeling extremely guilty that I think the whole of Poland gets something like three paragraphs in the book. Now, it just so happened 6 weeks ago I was in Krakow in the south of Poland, and there are four bars there, each of which has got a minimum of 80 different Polish beers. And they're not the same ones in the four bars. You know, between them, you could, if you really wanted to spend a summer holiday there, you could do 200 different Polish beers in this one town. And that is an astonishing leap forward, because when we checked them out 18 months previously, we were really struggling to get more than three or four brewery stories out of them. So.
The caption here in your book, under the rest of Europe, which is what you have Poland under,
yeah.
It says, having seen their historic breweries gobbled up by the major multinationals, Poles are gradually turning towards a nascent craft brewing culture. So I guess it's happened.
Yeah, we knew something was kind of happening, but I met the guys who run the Polish Beer Consumers Organization, and they were saying, oh, God, it's really bad. We're struggling to find three or four breweries at the moment. This was 18 months ago, 2 years ago, and just the last 6-12 months, something's changed. There's guys making Polish IPAs, and you taste them, and you think, well, yeah, they're not kind of regular IPAs. There's something edgy there. And they've reinvented this type of beer, which was a very Polish style, which is a smoked wheat beer. And I know some of these guys well enough for them to say, we really don't know what it tasted like originally. But here's three or four different goes at it. And each one tastes significantly different. And you think, they're all quite nice. I wonder which one bears relationship to the original. But does it really matter?
I have a feeling the original was brewed like that by many different people in many different small breweries, you know?
It may well be. Yeah. May well be. Yeah.
And Tim's point is well made. Does it matter? I mean, if we're... And this is what... Because I always crack on about how, you know, the stylification, if you will, of beer is almost to its detriment. Because you get people saying, well, this is a good beer, but it's not to style. It's like, well, it's still a good beer. Why does it matter that it's not to style? It's still something that you want to drink. And I think ultimately we have to kind of refocus ourselves to, you know what? Hey, this is a good beer. This is what I want to drink and I enjoy drinking. And not get so hung up on whether it's exactly a British style IPA or what have you.
Yeah, I don't believe that the great beers of years gone by were created by somebody imitating exactly what somebody else did. I think they probably took a few lessons from what somebody else has achieved and then did it slightly differently. That to me makes more sense.
Well, you hit on a style that we're seeing from some of the new small breweries. Barrier, which is based in Long Island, I'm actually drinking right now their new beer, Le Pit, which is a smoked wit, and also Freigeist, which is a small brewery out of Cologne, which is breaking. You know, there's a couple small breweries in Cologne that aren't just making Kolsch. We actually have a beer that we're going to put on probably this weekend called Hoppediced, which is also a smoked wit. So it seems to be your getting, well, you know what's going on.
Well, as soon as you come up with something that is supposed to be a really button-down style, somebody's going to go and do something that questions it. And I mean, even with Kolsch, you've got the regulated Kolsch brewers. But if you're sitting in Cologne and you're drinking Kolsch, one of the most interesting of the style, absolutely to the style, is one that isn't allowed to be called Kolsch. So what do you do with that?
Right. I mean, I was in Munich this summer and chased down a Munich IPA. You know, I mean, 5 years ago, 3 years ago, would you ever have found a Munich IPA? That's insane. In Toronto, we have a new brewery up that's making waves called Bellwoods Brewing. And they have done a smoked Berliner Weiss for the summer, which is absolutely phenomenal. Does smoked Berliner Weiss exist as a style? No. Should it be at the GABF as a style category for judging? No, it shouldn't. It's ridiculous. But it's a really good beer. So, you know, why not?
All right. Well, I'm so lucky to be sitting here with Tim Webb and Steve Beaumont from the World Atlas of Beer. It's just out. We're lucky that we're getting them at the start of their tour. They might be a little tired in a week or two. And let's give one quick shout-out to our sponsor, GreatBrewers.com. They actually are the distributors of the beers we're drinking tonight, Chimay, as well as the Del Borgo Dutchess Sec. And thanks to the Good Beer Sale and Association of 41 New York City Good Beer Bars, including Jimmy's Number 43, and we're places where you can drink these beers. So, hey, we'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio.
You're listening to Bleeding by Cherry Holmes on the Heritage Radio Network.org.
Well, my friend, they said they saw you out hanging with another man. Well, they said they saw you holding him tight and out holding hands. I've been for you to be true, but I don't think you've heard a sound. You keep going on and pushing those buttons to keep me around. Oh, you can't imagine what you've put through with all of the lying and cheating to do. You know what you're doing is tearing me apart.
Welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. I'm here with my esteemed guests, Tim Webb and Steve Beaumont, authors of The World Atlas of Beer, and Bobo from Chimay. Tim, tell us about local beer.
Well, one of the ways the world is going is that although the beer trade over 100 years has been about building up particular brands that people get a loyalty to and they always drink the same thing, what's happening at the moment, I think the U.S. is ahead of everywhere else, but the rest of the world is going in the direction of the American market. people want different things. It's a bit like the wine market. And the great thing with beer is that you can brew a good beer anywhere. There are some superb examples. We've just spattered the end of our book with a few examples of stuff. My favorite is Norfolk Island, which most people, unless they collect stamps, have never heard of Northern Ireland. Most people, unless they collect stamps, have never heard of Norfolk Island. It's about 800 miles off the coast of Australia. It's 800 miles from New Zealand. It's 800 miles from islands called New Caledonia. It's nowhere. Now, in the middle of this is a guy called Woody, and he produces New Zealand-style pale ales and I think a porter, I think a stout, in his own little brewery. He's got a good niche market going in Norfolk Island, as I understand it. He's actually got prizes in New Zealand for brewing the best New Zealand-style beers. And this is a guy who's just doing his own thing. And I love this. And we found other examples on Rarotonga in the Cook Islands. I've had beers brought back to me from Easter Island, which is off about 1,500 miles off the Chilean coast in South Pacific. It's getting everywhere. And that has got to be a future. It's got to be about what you can brew locally and small scale. And then there will be some beers, of course, which are just superbly produced by certain producers, and they will take their market, and so they should. But the beer market is going in a really interesting place at the moment.
That's one of the exciting things about this book. And Jimmy, you can turn to the South American section, and you can find these amazing breweries that you thought, why the hell are there breweries there? You know, I was down in Mendoza, and Tim was down in Mendoza in Argentina and Brazil, that little area that's known for winemaking. There's a cluster of breweries down there. And Easter Island, which is still, it's an Argentinian possession, isn't it?
Chilean possession.
Naparui, yeah. There's a brewery on there that's attached to a hotel. It's just, it's phenomenal to find these breweries happening in places where logic dictates they shouldn't be. I mean, you know, the craft brewery market in South America is about 0.2 of a percentage point of the overall beer market. But it's growing. And the Brazilians, you know, I mentioned earlier on about the Italian learning curve and how they came up in 5 years. Literally in a year and a half, the Brazilian brewers, particularly in Curitiba, which is halfway between Sao Paulo and the southern Brazilian border, they have just gone astronomically forward, just phenomenal beers. I still have a magnum of Pedregosa from Bodebrown in Curitiba in my fridge at home that I'm just trying to find enough people around to drink, because it's a 9.5% double IPA. And it's like, you don't want to open a magnum of that when it's just you. Yeah. And you need to make tasting notes. But it really is phenomenal that these beers are busting out all over.
I have a few more questions for you guys. What's the future in the Far East and Africa, for example?
That's two separate questions.
Yes, it is. Let's start with China, maybe. Okay.
Well, I mean, the Far East is really interesting. I mean, you've got Japan, where you've got about 250 new breweries, of which I would reckon about 80 to 90 are extremely high quality. They're producing stuff that's as good as the best craft brewers in the U.S., and they deserve a market. You then look at China, and the position is very different. If the Chinese drink 1 liter of beer more on average per year, that wipes out the total production of craft brewers in North America. That's the size of the difference. But the international brewers are assuming that China will be their salvation for those sorts of reasons. However, China's coming out of Maoism. It's going into capitalism. China is moving away from everybody being the same into the glorifying things being different. Are they seriously all going to go for the same beer brand? I suspect not. Also, this is a country where food is, they relish the flavors of different things. That, to me, plays into the hand of craft beer. Final fact about China, the brewing schools in China have all been supported by German brewery Braumeisters. Very clever move on the part of the Germans. So you've got this new generation of Chinese brewers who are being trained to appreciate high standard production. Are they seriously going to carry on making snow lager? I don't think so. So I see everything converging, and maybe China is going to be the point at which the future of beer is determined to be far more about difference in quality and flavor than it is about standardization and everybody buying the same thing because the adverts are good.
Two other really important Chinese notes, I think, is that China is now a hop-producing country. We have a map in the Atlas about hop-producing nations and regions. And China is still young in terms of hop production, but it is stepping up. So ultimately, China could become a major hop producer, which is important because right now China is producing twice as much beer as a country than the next largest beer producing country in the world, which is the U.S. So you're talking about a phenomenal amount of beer, and the hops are obviously they're high alphas. That's what the big brewers want. That's what they're craving, but as craft beer starts to get a hold in China, I can see a lot more specialty hop production starting up in there. And the other thing is to remember that the Chinese do appreciate quality. You know, I had a meeting a little while ago with the brand ambassador for Louis Treize or Louis XIII Cognac, which is a $2,700 a bottle cognac. And he told me that the vast majority of their sales are in duty-frees on the way back to China. And that's because the Chinese can buy this high-quality cognac, which is actually really good. And they know it's... but they know it's authentic. And that's a big deal for them. They know it's the real deal. So authenticity and quality is becoming an increasingly important thing for the Chinese. And I think that that's a market that is really, really worth watching in beer in the future.
Let's go back to local. So, Tim, you brought an English beer that's pretty unusual. Want to tell us about that? We have that in our glass right now.
Well, in the middle of all this stuff about craft beer, the UK has got a problem. We can claim to have kicked off the original beer revolution in part because of the Campaign for Real Ale back in 1971 and a kind of outcry against bad quality beer taking over and good quality beer to come back, and in part because of Michael Jackson, who was despite all things, he was British, and we pack a bigger punch. However, the actual breweries in the UK have felt a little bit held back by that kind of thing. They only want to produce cask condition light ales, which is the big British thing. Now, the beer we got here is one of the beers that is kicking against that, would be a wrong way to put it, but it's emerging out of what's happening now. This is one of the St. Austell Brewery in St. Austell in Cornwall. It's a regional brewery. It's the nearest regional brewery in the UK to New York, as it happens. Now, the guy who is the head brewer there produces some excellent beers for the real ale trade in the UK, but the owners of the brewery have just bought him a microbrewery, and they put it inside the old brewery, and he's allowed to play with some of the existing brands, which is a very long-winded introduction to saying, this is Smuggler's Ale, which is traditionally a 6-7% beer. It's quite dark, except this one he's done Grand Cru in his microbrewery. This is 13%. This is aged for quite a long while. This is a heavy beer. It comes out in 75 centiliter bottles. this is not at all the British tradition. But on the other hand,
that's
the
750
beer
mil for those of you who are not centiliter. Right. Yeah.
Oh god, it's probably something in fluid ounces as well. But the imperial, no. Anyway, look, this is a massive beer. It's a 13%. It's a barley wine style. It mimics the history of St Austell Brewery, which was always famous in the southwest of England for producing quite strong beers. But it's a beer that he can produce because he can, and that's one of the great things about the new brewers who have got a future because of their professional skills. They manage to get their breweries to allow them to produce something that is really spectacularly different. And I'm sat here. I've been sat here the last few minutes drinking this beer. It's the first time I've actually tried it, and I'm thinking, my God, that's British. Wow, we might just arrive on the scene eventually. And but yeah, this is a good example of it. It's whether or not the Cornish would see it as local to their tradition, I don't know, but they would probably be very proud that it's come out of a local brewery.
I have to agree with you, Tim. It there's something about this beer that tastes very British, even with that alcoholic oomph that it's got to it. There's no mistaking it for a Belgian or a Dutch or even an American beer. There's something very distinctly British about this.
Right. Tim, when you came in earlier, you said that you had had a couple before the show. What beers did you have before you came in today?
Oh my God! I've been in the U.S. for about 24 hours, and one of the things that has impressed me since the last time I was here, only about a year ago, is that a lot of ordinary regular bars have got some craft beers of the more popular variety, but they seem to be everywhere. So I've had a Lagunitas IPA. I have had what else have I had, Steve?
6 Points Toasted Lager.
Thank you. I had two others from a brewery called Kelso, one of which was a huge success, and was an unfortunate name, but I gather it's called Fuku. Fuku, okay.
That's the Momofuku custom beer, which I don't know what it is. But
I'm British, so I looked at the name.
Where did you have these beers?
Amazing place.
We had them at Good Beer.
Good Beer. Great
the first two was at just a restaurant, but then we went over to Good Beer between First and A on 9th.
East 9th Street. Yeah.
And let me tell you, as a beer writer for the last 30 years, I've been there and I've done most things, I walked into that place and I just thought, that is exactly the sort of store we need loads of in the UK. I just walked in and I thought, well, wonderful. Anyway, I hope he's listening when I say this.
It's a great expression of the whole beer scene in New York now. These cool hybrid beer stores where you can get a pint and you can get a growler fill. Yeah. There's a lot opening up in the city.
I think it's a very sensible idea. I mean, what you need in the beer world around the world is what do you want if you are a beer drinker? What do you want? Do you want to go somewhere, sample a few, and then buy a few? If so, what's wrong with that? Why not address your licensing systems to allow that to happen?
So I spent a lot of time in New York in the 90s when really it was difficult to find a bar restaurant that wasn't specialty like DBA or what have you, but just an ordinary place that didn't have anything more than Heineken and Amstel. Because New York was then known as the import beer place. It was not what you drank, it was the bottle that you drank it from. And, once 2000 hit, New York just changed so much. And, I often think about my old friend and brewery owner, Kirby Shire, who ran Zip City back in the day. And Zip City, it got some grief from some of the local beer people because, I don't know, it was... There was politics involved that I'm not entirely aware of, but I always enjoyed Zip City's beers, and ultimately Zip City died because it couldn't do the rent thing. Now Zip City fits in perfectly with what's happening in beer in New York. And it would honestly be just a normal stop on the beer circuit in this city now. But you know, New York is one of definitely one of the best places to drink beer in the United States now, simply because of those pioneering efforts and because now you can go almost anywhere and get a decent beer.
And as a tourist, perhaps, I love those tall buildings.
Well, we know coming up, there's some new breweries opening in New York. Single Cut Beersmith, Rich Buchetta, who's been on our show. We're waiting for his brewery to open up in Queens. There's Rockaway Brewing, which is like a super micro, like one barrel nano in Queens as well. And a couple other guys are contracting, like Alphabet City Brewing and some outside of the city, Spider Bite, So there's a lot of new guys making beer in the city. I think there's going to be a lot more. And I like what you said. At the time of Kirby Shire and Zip City, I mean, there were quite a few small brew pubs and small breweries in the city. And most of them went out of business.
Yeah.
I think now you're going to look forward to seeing a lot more in New York.
I just hope Rockaway Brewing does a summer beer called Rockaway Beach. You gotta.
Well, for a while, the only place you could get Rockaway Brewing was at Rockaway Beach. And they've been to a few places like Jimmy's Number 43. You guys are great. We're going to wrap up the show in a minute. Again,
before you do, Jimmy, I've got one important piece of news. We've remembered the name of the Austrian Trappist brewery. It's Stift Engelzell. Okay.
That sounds. You got to say that again in an English accent.
Stift. That's S-T-I-F-T. Engelzell. E-N-G-E-L.
I don't think that's going to pass the state board of liquor or whatever in many states. Stift,
And that was without,
I got stift on stift.
That was without Google. That was just us coming together and trying to figure out the name.
Well, you guys wrote the goddamn World Atlas of Beer. So again, Tim Webb, Stephen Beaumont, World Atlas of Beer. By the time the show airs, you'll have finished your tour, but just know that we're their first stop on the tour. And again, Bobo from Chimay. Everyone knows you as Bobo.
Yes, sir.
We're gonna take a little break, and we're gonna go hang out and have a couple more beers at Jimmy's Number 43. We're sitting in the back room where all the kegs are being moved around, and you guys have been very gracious. But we're really happy to get you guys. Also, when this show airs, we'll be promoting November 6th. Don't miss the Heritage Radio Network's exclusive election night coverage. I'll be there, and Mike Edison from the Mike and Judy Show, and a couple other hosts will be watching the election results come in and provide a fresh perspective on American politics and policy. Tune into the live stream, election night, November 6th. Hopefully what we'll be doing is going across the country, talking to some breweries in swing states, and getting a little, cross-section of America. In closing, I'd like to thank our sponsors at greatbrewers.com who have helped to bring this podcast to you tonight. We're also supported by the Good Beer Seal. Thanks to Tim, Stephen, Red, and Bobo for joining me here on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks to our producers, Jack Inslee and Brie O'Connor, and our engineer, Joe Galarraga. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Beer Sessions Radio.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.